Somewhere lost in the clouded annals of history lies a place that few have seen. A mysterious place called the unknown, where long forgotten stories are revealed to those who travel through the wood.
Dorkness to Light, hosted by Emily and Alan Middleton.
We aim to explore what takes place at the corner of theology and geekology.
Episode 9, Into the Unknown.
Welcome to Episode 9 of Dorkness to Light. This is our show where we take a look at pop culture in terms of where those stories intersect with concepts in religion, faith, theology, and spirituality.
It's the season of harvest, and for this seasonally themed episode, we're looking at Emily's new favorite thing to watch at Halloween, the 2014 Cartoon Network miniseries, Over the Garden Wall.
It is, in my opinion, a perfect Halloween show. I feel that this show perfectly captures both the lighthearted and utterly terrifying aspects of the holiday, especially the way that it is practiced in America. This episode is mostly going to be a chance for us to go a little further afield from organized religion and delve into the weird corners of American superstition at this weird, surreal time of the year.
We'll talk a little bit about the series every now and then and use some examples from that. But mostly, as Emily said, we're going to talk about just some of the things,
the thematic
that watching
things
that made us think of.
Yes.
So it's not going to be so heavy on that.
I'm going to try to avoid direct plot spoilers because I do highly recommend that everyone go and watch this. Mm-hmm. Now, unlike a lot of Halloween shows, it is not so directly tied to Halloween that you can only watch it on October 31st. So I actually highly recommend that everybody go out and find it because it is a great harvest season show. And within the course of the show, it spans, it looks like a couple of weeks, gauging from the art design, because when you first see the main characters, Wirt and Greg, wandering through the woods, it's still green, maybe a couple leaves are starting to change color, but by the end, it is like the dead of winter, and the plots and the themes reflect that changing of the seasons. There's going to be a lot of thematic discussion,
yes,
lots of talking about events or characters and how they relate, tropes and themes in fairy tales, but there won't be direct plot spoilers, so
right,
say like half spoiler alerted.
Right. And it's Halloweenish for the first three quarters of it, just because it's kind of weird and eerie and a little creepy.
Yes.
It becomes specifically Halloweenish towards the end.
The elevator pitch for this story is incredibly simple. Two brothers, Wirt and Greg, are lost in the woods. And that's about the extent of the story. It is the two of them wandering through this forest that they have no idea how they got into, really, and the various characters and people and situations they run into along the way. It follows in a very fairy tale folklore formula of kids lost in the woods. It's reminiscent of Uncle Remus, Hansel and Gretel. Any sort of story that you can think about that features the woods.
Capital T, capital W, as the dark place you don't go into.
Yes, and once you're in, it's really hard to find your way back to reality. I love it so much because it is, in keeping with this theme of it being perfect for Halloween, a kid's show, but not really. I will say this, if you're looking for something to watch with your six-year-old, this might terrify them a lot. There's some heavy themes of death, abandonment, terror. I mean, there's some people selling their souls, all right? Like, so maybe like a 9 or 10 year old threshold.
Mm-hmm.
As we said, the show originally aired on Cartoon Network in 2014. It was part of the Cartoon Network Renaissance, as a lot of people refer to it. A lot of groundbreaking, really interesting and artistic shows were being aired at that time. Over the Garden Wall, Adventure Time, Steven Universe, things like that.
It's from that same general era of content in the Cartoon Network.
And it has that same sort of weird, offbeat, lighthearted, but with very dark undertones and subject matter.
You came across it last year in 2015.
Yes, and I watched it for the first time last year. That was when it got released on DVD, so of course lots of people were talking about it again. And I watched it and I was just blown away by how well written, and then how artistic, how well directed, how well paced. It was just a phenomenal experience. And then when we started thinking about, okay, well, what sorts of things could we talk about? I really wanted to talk about something weird.
Mm-hmm.
And this is definitely weird. Also a chance for us to talk about kind of how weird America is. So we are simultaneously a very, very religious nation and really, really superstitious. People talk a lot about the lessening religiosity of the American people, that more and more people are saying that they are undecided about their religion or that they hold no religion. Agnosticism and atheism are both on the rise. But there's some stats about that that I found. 68% of Americans believe in angels and demons. And that's not entirely surprising when you say 80-90% of Pentecostals and evangelicals and Protestant Christians believe pretty strongly that angels and demons are real. A lot of people in America feel that spiritual forces are really strong in their life. And that holds true for people who have no religious affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
Belief in ghosts and contact with the dead has doubled in the last 30 years, basically at the same rate that agnosticism has been rising. So has this superstitious kind of generalist feeling of being able to commune with ghosts. And we've seen that reflected in our horror movies all the time, since it is Halloween after all. Lots of people are probably watching The Exorcism of Emily Rose, or The Exorcist, or the various other exorcism
movies, right?
Paranormal Activity.
The Conjuring.
Yes.
Fits into those categories.
It's a thing that Americans are incredibly fascinated by.
Mm-hmm. Emily, you're probably a little too young to have been on the beginning end of this, but in the, I would say, mid-80s, maybe into the 90s, angels became a hot thing. Again, not just in overtly religious communities, but in other places as well. Angels were everywhere, and maybe ghosts and demons is the next logical step from there, or is at least coming out of the same phenomena.
Yeah, the same sort of, you know, I like to say social need.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That same drive. The rise of supernatural over the last, whatever now, 11 years, this has become just sort of a widely accepted, we've joked before about the Babylon Bee, saying how much of a Christian demonology is based around that show. It's a major part of pop culture. We've kind of had a resurgence of that in recent years. And this all ties into Americans and their relationship with Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people in America love Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Love Halloween so much, which is kind of impressive given the amount of smear campaigns that the holiday has been through.
And before you get into the anti side of it, one just thing I sense on the pro-Halloween side that I think for a while people were using as an excuse, because it's great for the kids. The kids love to dress up and the candy. I love Halloween because my kids love Halloween. I think now adults on their own are more comfortable saying, I love Halloween for me. Maybe in the same way that maybe geeks a dozen years ago about comic books.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I read those when I was a kid with my nephew. I read comics with him as opposed to, yes, I love reading comics myself. So I think on the pro side, I think maybe so that facade has been dropped.
Which
that
is,
it's just about the kids, because it's about everybody.
Which is fantastic. Honestly, I am not a person who loves Halloween the way my friends do, but mm-hmm. I love how much they love Halloween. If we're going to talk about the history of Halloween, let's go all the way back to the beginning, to Samhain, or as it is, we're hopefully correctly pronounced, Savna. It's Gaelic, and that's my best guess. It is the original, final autumn holiday mm-hmm. of the Celtic year cycle, now the pagan mm-hmm. year cycle. It was basically the signal that the light half of the year was ending, and that it was, from this point on, the era of darkness, until we could get back to, well, Easter.
Right.
There's a lot of discussion about this, about modern-day pagans working really hard to reclaim Samhain. And making that an important holiday and getting recognition for it. And, you know, right on, guys. But there's also a push from within that community to make people recognize how the Catholic Church totally stole it from us. And the Catholic Church has never made it, had never had any qualms about that. They 100% did steal Samhain.
A missionary approach, a standard operating procedure, was to find a local holiday, a local celebration, and figure out a similar or equivalent or compatible celebration that they could place at around the same time. That's not a secret. That's the point of that story that sort of surprises me.
And part of that is obviously super intentional, but there's just something about the end of October that mm-hmm. feels yep. important. People talk about it all the time when you're going out and it's PSLs are back and there's cinnamon in the air and there's pumpkins everywhere and things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
That it, you can feel it on the breeze. You can smell it in the air. You just know it in your skin and your bones that something important is happening. And there is then a push within human nature to be like, well, clearly something important is happening here. Let's try and figure out what it is.
And of course, we have Halloween as Halloween because it's All Hallows Eve, the day before All Hallows or All Saints Day, November 1st, followed by All Souls Day, November 2nd. So the notion among some on the religious Christian side that Halloween has nothing to do with them is again a factually and historically incorrect notion.
Speaking of history, I love Catholic history, which is basically just European history.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about European history and realize that it is also Catholic history, things get so incredibly weird. And I love it. The Puritans fled England because everything was just getting too gosh darn creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And they immediately took off to America. The early to mid 19th century obsession with spiritualism and seances and fortune tellers. It's just sort of incredible to think that there is sort of this scientific boom. And at the exact same time, this sort of super scientific boom.
And in some cases, within the same people.
Yes. People like to talk about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle,
mm-hmm.
creator of Sherlock Holmes, this great man of science and intellect and factuality.
And Conan Doyle was a strong believer in the existence of the fae and the fairy world.
And this is a thing that never really made the transfer across the pond.
Right.
The belief in fairies and tree spirits,
sprites,
river spirits, sprites.
Dryads, naiads, and wood sprites and beings like that.
that belief system just never transferred to America for actually rather intentional reasons, because that's why the Puritans left. And it's just so fascinating to think about how recent a lot of those beliefs were in Victorian England, that I found a really awesome lithograph of a woman in a blindfold being led by other women to place her hands in bowls of barley and water. And I'm just looking at that and I'm like, that's a witch. My American brain saw that and immediately recognized that's a witch. And I read the caption and it was a common Halloween form of soothsaying, which would predict whether or not a woman would get married or pregnant in the following year. Yeah, this is just what people did on Halloween parties. And I'm like, on the one hand, I could see why the Puritans were freaked out. And on the other hand, oh, I see where the Puritans got their ideas. I wanted to take this as a chance to sort of reach out and talk a little bit about paganism without making it an explicit topic, mostly because I don't really know what I'm talking about. So there's going to be a lot of talking about pagan practices and Savna and such like in this episode. But I do also want to point out that modern paganism really, really likes to say that there is like this long history of witchcraft in America. And it's really not true. That if you go back to the Puritans, it wasn't witches. It was people just persecuting each other based on their religious beliefs for being too Catholic, basically.
Part of that is just a matter of definitions and words having different meanings over a couple hundred years. I'm reminded of the very early church and some of those persecutions from the Roman emperors was the charge that these Christians were atheists. Because they did not believe in the gods. They're also heroes of the Christian faith and atheists.
Yes.
So that word just has multiple meanings at different parts in time. And in the Puritan world, basically, if you didn't toe the line, any deviation from the well-worn path was not just error or mistake. Or
diversity.
It was witches!
Heresy!
So that charge has multiple meanings to it, and we're pulling out one modern meaning and examining it. So I think that's part of where that misunderstanding comes from.
Yes. I just find it really interesting that there actually is this sort of, I don't know, strangely symbiotic relationship between paganism and Catholicism. And I think that paganism is stronger when it recognizes its maybe unwanted maternal influence from the Catholic Church, but that is a part of what has been incorporated into modern paganism, along with Celtic traditions and going back to herbal women and earth women and all of that sort of tradition. I really love syncretic religions. Paganism is one, and I wish that more pagans recognized that interesting history, because there's just something so sad about Catholics being persecuted as witches, in my mind.
And that Puritan heritage that we have here in the U.S., I think, does still create a stream of anti-Halloween movement within some aspects of the church.
Yes, and also some aspects of the mainstream society. You know, let's think of the Satan panics, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, that was from within the church, but also from without. This goes back to that statistic that I mentioned earlier about, you know, vast majority of Christians believe in demons and angels. But a lot of people who aren't Christian still ascribe power to spiritual, supernatural beings. So I said a little bit earlier, a thing that America is really, really lacking is a tradition of fairies. And, you know, a lot of people grow up on fairy tales. Disney is such an important aspect of the socializing of American children. It is incredible. But all of those fairy tales came from other places. But there is a very distinct lack of fairy tales in America. And it means that American folklore tends to break down into one of two options. That you either have the legendary frontiersman, mm-hmm. your Johnny Appleseed.
Paul Bunyan.
Exactly. Those kinds of characters in, like, the conception of what America is. Mm-hmm. Where they're not real people, but they're, like, personified ideas or right. ideals. But there is another kind of folklore. And it's very similar to fairy tales. Don't go out in the woods. There's monsters out there. You need to be careful. But the things that are waiting out there are not fairies. They're demons. And a really interesting thing that I found when watching the behind the scenes for Over the Garden Wall is that the main antagonist, the evil in the woods, the beast, was originally called Old Scratch. Which, if you are a very old person or sat down and listened to your grandparents tell stories or sing really, really old folk songs, that's Satan. Like, actual factual Satan is the bad guy in this show.
Even changing it to the beast has some of those revelation-y implications, but it can be read a different way.
Yes.
So the updated, edited version is a little bit softer, but it's still the same thing.
Which is hilarious because no kid would have gotten that. But of course, you can't say it's Satan, but it's Satan. And that is just such a puritanical idea mm-hmm. of
that what's out in the woods, the danger, the darkness, is the ultimate evil.
Exactly. There is nothing in between. That's a thing that I always find interesting about Protestantism is, I guess, probably because most Protestants don't believe in ghosts, but still want to mm-hmm. believe that something's out there.
Right.
Demons are the only answer. But to still keep this with a sort of Savannah, pagan, historical context, the beast in his character design looks very much like the Horned King or some other form of wood spirit. Mm-hmm. And he is literally a wood spirit. He's got, you know, big antlers that are branches and these big piercing eyes, and it's otherwise just a mass of black. But he follows rules.
We all know the beast, Pilgrim.
So in a weird sense, he is this sort of perfect blend of what Halloween is, of a blend of this pagan, fairy, you have to make deals, they follow certain mm-hmm. rules, but also the devil wants your soul. You're lost in the woods.
Ooh, better be wise and don't believe his lies. For once your will begins to spoil, he'll turn you to a tree of oil and use you in his lantern for to burn.
Now, Emily, you were raised in the 90s and the 2000s. And we were in, I think we figured out, three sort of main churches in that time and a handful of different religious schools. I was wondering whether you experienced some of that anti-Halloween from sort of inside evangelicalism.
I was lucky enough to pretty much always have a relatively neutral, mm-hmm. positive experience with Halloween. I don't remember anybody going on any sort of crazed screeds, which I really appreciate.
You wouldn't have gotten that from us, but you never know, one teacher or one youth leader.
Of course, we did not have Halloween parties.
Right.
Which, really, for either reason, the pagan or the Catholic.
Right.
our mainline Protestant churches
right.
did not go in for that. So, but we did have alternatives. We still had harvest festivals, which I think even at a pretty young age, always found really ironic.
Yeah.
Because I read enough fantasy to right. know about Celtic pagan original Halloween fertility rituals and thought to myself, oh yes, the Catholic holy day is too pagan. We're just going to go right back to the source.
Exactly.
That'll be That's less it. Pagan.
That's right. That is sort of a Protestant idea, isn't it? We'll just skip right over all of the Catholic history and jump right into, I don't know, Druid worship.
Yeah.
Our Druid heritage. It is a little odd.
And so Protestant, just like, as long as you're not Catholic.
And anything else is okay.
We can deal with it. Oh, God.
Sad but true. Sad but true. But these harvest festivals were often dress-up affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So where would your love of cosplay be with that? This was your proto-cosplay.
It was. I made all of my own Halloween costumes, or most of my own Halloween costumes, and... You know, it was just good fun. I never got really into Halloween, and
right.
I think that's because I don't have any siblings. I think why kids love Halloween so much is because it's a tradition that's almost passed down, not parents to kids, but kid to kid.
Right.
Like, there's something there about, like, the older kids taking their younger siblings out on Halloween. That's
right.
Just such a Halloween concept of like, okay, you're the older kid, so you're not as scared. You need to be there for your little brother.
And Halloween does have an implied coming-of-age aspect to it, which is to say, when do you stop dressing up?
Indeed. I mean,
there is this sort of life change, this threshold that occurs as part of the maturing process.
Indeed. I really want to talk about Halloween and liminal spaces. I've been talking your ear off for about a week, just using the word liminal in as many sentences as possible.
What do we believe in on this podcast and all our podcasts?
Defining your terms.
Defining your terms. What is liminal in a liminal space?
This is a term that was, as far as I can tell, originally come up with in the 20th century by anthropologists who wanted to talk about the anthropology of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted a word that would describe the feeling of ambiguity or disorientation in the middle of a transitional ritual. And a transitional ritual would be anything that is like a coming-of-age ritual or even a wedding. There is a woman who comes in the back and she's unmarried. By the time she gets out that door again at the end of the scenario, she is married. And in the time in between...
A transition has happened.
In the time in between, what is she? She is a bride. Who is neither married nor unmarried.
Right. So this idea of the liminal space, another way of explaining it is a threshold.
Yes, which is where the word comes from.
And in marital practice, there's the carrying over of the threshold. Again, that doorway represents us as a couple not being married, not being together, not cohabitating, to doing all of those things. That is, walking across that step, embraced and locked together, is symbolic of crossing the threshold.
That you have now become different people through this ritual. And so it doesn't have to be a religious ritual, as mm-hmm. we just said. Mm-hmm. There's some relatively sure. secular examples. A liminal space in the general sense also refers to anything that feels unreal. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people like to talk about, say, that feeling when you walk into a Walmart at 1:30 in the morning. Where you woke up in the middle of the night and just couldn't go to sleep because you had a pounding headache and you had to get up and go to the Walmart at 1 a.m. to buy cough medicine. And you walk into that building and you suddenly feel like you're on an alien planet. Everything is completely recognizable. It's the same store you may have been to 2 or 3 times that week. But there's no one there. And it sounds different. And it smells different. And it feels different. And it's just weird. Liminal spaces are also really, really important in folk tales.
Mm-hmm.
For example, to take a Celtic example, Lu, who is celebrated at Lunasa, one of the earlier two mm-hmm. pagan/Celtic harvest rituals, he could not be killed in the morning, at night, dressed nor undressed, wet nor dry, something like that. And so the way he is originally killed is someone tricks him into wearing a net, standing with 1 foot in a river at twilight.
Sundown or twilight, right.
And is thus...
Where all of these thresholds, all of these meeting places, all these transitional activities occur.
They all intersect in this one moment, and thus that moment has power.
Mm-hmm. The idea of this transition or this, what's the other phrase, thinner? Where we hear that where the
walls, the barrier, of reality.
The barriers between these realms are thinner. Comic book people understand this in terms of an Earth 1, Earth 2 situation. Mm-hmm. There, place those crossover places.
This was crisis. Mm-hmm. This was the walls of reality are falling down. Over the Garden Wall does a great job of showing this artistically and within the plot structure and the writing as well, because there is this real sense of uncertainty.
Yes.
Nothing is explained. In your first episode, you're just dropped into the woods, and ooh. Wirt, the elder brother, even says,
"Where are we?"
"In the woods?"
"I mean, what are we doing out here?"
"We're walking home."
"Greg, I think we're lost."
And from that point on, every person that they meet, they are uncertain about who they are, what they are,
why they are.
One of the first things they do to establish that this is indeed a fairy tale is they meet a talking bluebird, mm-hmm. which is just such an American Disney icon.
That's true.
"Maybe I can help you. I mean, you guys are lost, right?"
"What in the world is going on? A bird's brain isn't big enough for cognizant speech."
"Hey, what was that?"
"I mean, I'm just saying you're weird. Like, not normal. I mean, oh my gosh."
You talked about the sense of unease or the sense of weirdness. That was my impression of, and I've just watched it through once. And it's I don't know if we said this specifically, but it's a series of about 10 minute episodes or so.
Yes.
And you have this break time to sort of think about it while the next one queues up. And what I was getting out of it for about the first half really was that it was the dominant note that I was getting was tone. Some character, but certainly not plot or story. It was about the weird, the odd, the unusual, sort of figuring out what's going on. So I thought that was an interesting choice. Of what they were, what the focus was going to be on, mm-hmm. was on this weird tone.
Especially for those first five episodes. Episode mm-hmm. six is where things get real.
Right there.
Or rather, get really unreal. So in those first five episodes, the structure is very simple. You would recognize it from, say, an Uncle Remus story, mm-hmm. which I actually had a collection of my grandparents' collection.
That's right.
That it starts with the two brothers trying to find their way home, walking into a village, meeting a person, finding an old house, some event that they are then going to have to attempt to understand. One, they walk into a village, and it seems like a really normal late 19th century farming community.
Mm-hmm.
And when they meet the people are all vegetables. Greg, being about 7 or 8 years old, just rolls with it. Mm-hmm. He's like, "Awesome, these are the people, great." Wirt, being 13 or 14, is like, "This is not normal. This is weird. This needs an explanation." And then somebody walks up and says, "Why aren't you wearing your vegetables?" "Oh, they're wearing costumes." "They are wearing costumes.
But..."
But you don't know what's underneath them until the end of the episode. And that uncertainty then is continued out with their motives. To bring up another example of a great story that uses liminal space so beautifully, The Twilight Zone. Mm, it is your To Serve Man, where they walk into this village and it's really creepy and weird and eerie and they're, Wirt is immediately on edge. And then the people talk to them, and they seem nice and relatively friendly. And
the defenses go down until...
people realize that they want to leave. And suddenly it turns into a Stephen King novel for a few seconds. And it's like, oh no, they're going to kill us. And the head of the town, who is a giant maypole, says, "For your crimes against this town... you will do a few hours of manual labor."
Okay, that's not so crazy.
That's not awful. And then it sort of goes back to normal. And it's a pleasant, pastoral scene.
They're out doing work.
And it's wonderful.
Picking potatoes and digging ditches.
And then finally, Wirt's thinking to himself, I wonder why we're digging these holes. And the magical, talking, sassy bluebird Beatrice just says, well, maybe they're going to plant you out here. And then it manages to twist.
Again.
And again. Mm-hmm. And finally, we have our happy ending. And the boys leave town, but they still don't really know where they're going. They've just met this person, had this very strange interaction, and are off on their way again.
And that is what happens for those first handful of episodes. Strange interaction, weird things happen, sort of creepy, sort of Twilight Zone-ish, sort of unusual. And then we do eventually get a reveal that this is building to something. The story aspects do come around eventually.
Yes. And a thing that adds to this eerie, surreal weirdness is all of the different people that they meet are from vastly different time periods. Because mm-hmm. the first time that you're watching this, you think, okay, this could be rural New Hampshire or maybe even northern Indiana. It could kind of be anywhere.
Yeah.
And then you meet the villagers of Pottsfield. And they all have this very sort of turn of the 19th century pastoral garb. And you're like, okay, that's odd. You meet a woman who's dressed like Beatrix Potter and is teaching a schoolroom full of animals how to read and write and wear clothing.
That was one of my favorite parts, by the way.
It's fantastic.
The school was one of the highlights.
There's even an episode where Wirt blatantly calls this out, where they're inside a mansion, and they walk into another section of the mansion, and Wirt goes, oh, this is French Rococo. It doesn't really fit with the Georgian stylings we have seen up till this point. Beatrice sort of looks at him weird, and he goes, what, am I not supposed to know that? Wirt is a great nerd. I'm just going to say that, like, as far as a nerd character, basically, at some point in most of our lives, we were this kid. Straight up pretentious.
No. Though I am lost, my wounded heart resides back home, in pieces strewn about the graveyard of my lost love.
But he, being the voice of reason, also is the voice of pointing out, yeah, everybody, even if you're not great at your American history, all of these people are from radically different points in time. One of my favorite characters is actually a young woman who is a Puritan. And she and Wirt get to have a great interaction where she's talking about, oh, she's sickly. And her auntie whispers won't let her go to doctors because outsiders would corrupt her. And Wirt's like, yeah, that's super weird. Even if she's family, Lorna, the girl's like, oh, Auntie Whispers isn't my real aunt. And he's just like, what? What is happening here? This woman is like horrific and terrible, and she's doing all these horrible, awful things to Lorna because she wants to keep away the evils and to protect her from the influences of outsiders who will turn her wicked. Turns out she's actually possessed by a demon. So those sorts of themes of taking your expectations of what they have set up as fairy tale conceit and turning them, not even quite on their head, but turning them sideways.
At least 90 degrees, yeah.
So that it goes a direction that you didn't necessarily expect is a recurring theme throughout all of the episodes. So in all senses, this show plays with liminal space, that they move from one vignette to the other. You hardly ever see the transitions. They're just in a new place. Temporally, that these people are all from different periods and they all talk differently, act differently, have kind of different expectations from each other, but also from Greg and Wirt, who are very much outsiders to everything that's going on. As I said at the beginning, over the course of the 10 episodes, you can see the backgrounds slowly shifting to be less green, more red, more brown, more dead and white as they get towards the final episode. A lot of the episodes have this sort of hazy film almost over them, where they feel almost like an old photograph. That it's kind of a washed out watercolor sort of look that just makes it feel kind of old and timeless. And you can't ever really figure out what time it's set in. You just lose all sense of time in this place. And as we said, liminal space is really, really important in a lot of things that we would consider pagan or heathen. Like, those are times of power. Midnight, the witching hour, where it's still night, but it's the next day.
Right. That transition time occurs.
Mm-hmm. Or crossroads, or things like that. Just any place where two places are meeting and sort of melding into each other. And Halloween is the prime time for that.
When you were pitching me the concepts of liminal space and explaining that to me, I was interested in where the concept came from, because in my reading of theology, I had not run across the term, but it has these religious overtones. So I did wonder if they came from religion specifically. And you said it actually came from anthropology, but in the study of ritual and the study of religion. Because these concepts, you're talking about some of these things, and there are, to me, a few clear-cut implications or examples, most notably the 100% divine, 100% human Jesus Christ, being this meeting of heaven and earth. And just the idea then beyond that of sacred spaces, of early shrines being set up on the places where Christians not were born, but were killed.
You know,
martyrs and saints, and shrines being built up on those spaces. This idea, this thinning of reality of heaven and earth meeting. And I do think that that idea of the sacred space, that sort of language, has been a little bit lost in American evangelicalism, at least.
And in general Protestantism, that there's been a distancing from something we like to talk about, the communion of saints.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a thing, that you don't have connection with Christians before you who have died, where that's a really fundamental part of Catholicism, is that there is a continued lineage and connection of Christians unbound by time or death.
Right.
That's the entire point of the resurrection. Not just that this one guy came back from the dead, but that the veil of death has been shredded.
Right.
That there is now continuity between death. Death does not separate one from one's loved ones anymore. That's a really crucial aspect of Christian theology that I feel modern American Protestant evangelicals have largely distanced themselves from on purpose, because they're really uncomfortable with death.
I think there's a lot of truth in that.
There was a quote that you found. You want to read some of that?
This was the abstract of a theological dissertation, that liminal space is a space in between what was and what will be. Let me just stop there for a second and saying that there is an interesting theology that's developed in the last half century or so about the kingdom of God that talks about this now and the not yet of the kingdom, the what was or what is and what will be, and that meeting, the places where those meet. But back to this abstract, it says, it's crucial for ongoing Christian formation. However, the evangelical church currently has no space for supporting those in liminality. Evangelical theology and practice actively discourage those in liminal space. As a result, Christian maturity is frustrated. Future leaders and contemplatives are endangered. This dissertation explores how the evangelical church could acknowledge, support, and educate those in liminal spaces, to which I believe Emily as well, would give a hearty amen.
Amen.
So there is work in this area being done. There's light being brought to it in terms of Christian theology, and that encourages me greatly.
So fortunately, there are at least some people like you, like me, who live out here kind of in the border towns, in the fringes, in these weird corners of modern Christianity, some closer to the fringes, some closer to the mainstream, but all outside what would be considered generally accepted, a couple who might fall into my favorite phrase in the world, heterodox, neither orthodox nor heretical, but all the weirdness.
Yep.
So I'm glad to hear that that is being brought back.
Mm-hmm. And sort of as we were saying, this was something that is not as far lost among our Catholic brothers and sisters, who have a history of mysticism and mystics as heroes.
Visionaries, like literal visionaries.
Right, and when we evangelicals try to make sense of Teresa of Avila or St. John of the Cross, it gets really weird and confusing. From this side of the fence, we don't have a context for that as well. And I think this idea of liminal space, of making space for liminal space, would be a big step in that direction.
And to bring this back around to our main topic, one of the few places where you can find that place for liminal space in American general culture is on Halloween. Because it is a place where people feel, oh, maybe the veil is thinner. Maybe spirits can come through. Maybe strange, bizarre things can be explained on this day.
I think in one way that we see this desire, even though we wouldn't use the word in mainstream, this desire for liminal space or liminality, is in things like near-death experience, which was almost a genre of literature in the last decade or so. The visits to hell, the visits to heaven, the visits here and the visits there. Some of those books describing that became incredibly popular. I think that speaks to the human need for some sort of discussion in this area. Recognition that this area exists.
And a thing that I like about Over the Garden Wall, the entire story begins with a beautifully surreal image of a piano flying through space towards the viewer. And there is a frog playing the piano. And he sings a song which sets a lot of the tone and almost explains the plot and the point of the show.
Led through the mist by the milk light of moon, all that was lost is revealed. Our long bygone burdens, mere echoes of the spring. But where have we come and where shall we end? If dreams can't come true, then why not pretend? How the gentle wind beckons through the leaves as autumn colors fall.
So already in the opening theme song of the first episode, it sets up this feeling of narrative control, of who actually is telling the story. We don't really get an answer, because you could say it's the frog who's playing the song. Well, no, because he's not the narrator. Who's the narrator? Well, we're not entirely sure, and the story never tells us. But someone is telling this story, and we're not really sure even whose perspective it's from.
Right.
Or what sections of the story are true. It plays a lot with assumptions about what's going on and sets up very early on the importance of make-believe. This is one of the sections where childlike nature and inclination, represented by Greg, is just proven to be so vital to this story, because with Wirt being the cynic, Greg is the innocent, completely accepting, childlike viewer who just rolls with it. He's shown repeatedly through the second half of the series to be not immune to the dangers of the woods, but severely less susceptible because he has faith and trust in people. And he's not cynical and bitter and all of these sorts of things. That childlike hope and innocence protects him. I also want to play the ending song, which is the same tune, played by the same frog on a piano. What's interesting about the intro and closing credits of the first and last episode, respectively, is that the stories shown in the opening credits are not actually scenes from the show. They are small vignettes that feature characters that you will see. And what it essentially sets up is you see the first scene, the first sentence of all of these characters' stories. And then in the end credits, shows you the final lines, the endings for all of these stories in reverse.
How the gentle wind beckons through the leaves as autumn colors fall. Dancing in a swirl of golden memories, the loveliest lies of all.
And again, for a quote-unquote kids program, it does end with this thesis statement, but the thesis statement is still mysterious.
Yes.
This question of what are these lovely lies? Is it just story in general? I think that's probably part of it, but I think there are layers to it that I'm not getting. I think there are layers there that are probably subject to personal interpretation as well.
I think that thesis statement, what it encapsulates, what this show is, because one of the first questions that you asked me around episode 2 or 3, is this a ghost story? And I was like, no.
But maybe?
Because what I feel it is, in essence, over the garden wall is nostalgia. That if you want to know what it is a look inside the brain of Patrick McHale and his relationship to his own childhood. Because even when we get answers in episode 9, when we get answers like, oh, we know what's going on. We get it.
That is not the end of the questions. That is certainly not the end of the answers.
And even episode 10.
The last episode.
The very last episode, right before those final credits play, where we get the narrator again telling us, and so the story ends, and everyone is happy, and so on and so forth. And you see a few things in that final scene that we see before the show officially closes and goes into the credits that make you think, wait, if that part was just a story, then how can that be?
What? Wait.
And then you get that closing song, which ends with the loveliest lies of all. And you think, at least I think, that what this story is memory and nostalgia.
And those are the loveliest lies and we tell ourselves.
The loveliest lies that we tell ourselves are about the way things used to be. It continues to play with time throughout that whole series, mostly between about 1690 and maybe 1905. But we see some things that take place in a more recent time period, but it's not 2014.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the past.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we see takes place in the past. I think if you were going to give it a finite meaning, it is the stories and traditions and feelings and memories that we pass on from one generation to the next at these moments of growing up, at these moments when we are becoming adults. Because that is the thing about Halloween. You mentioned it earlier.
There is a coming-of-age aspect to it.
It is a holiday that you practice in an entirely different way. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not, depending on some people. At the ages of 3, 7, 14, 19, 26, 35, and 80.
They're all different.
And there's this generational aspect of passing on what Halloween means, what it is, what it feels like.
Those traditions are family traditions as much as they are also traditions of our friends and culture and society and community. But a lot of that is the family passing these traditions on. Well, I am glad you talked me into watching this show, because there was a lot more to it than I expected in terms of the things we're talking about today, and I just want to put a plug in for the quality of the piece itself.
Yes.
I thought that Over the Garden Wall, as you said, it sort of comes from this Cartoon Network renaissance. It certainly fits into that era in terms of the story quality, the voice acting,
the animation quality.
The animation quality, all those technical things.
If you ever wanted to listen to Frodo talk to a bird, that happens.
But I really like the story structure. And we did not spoil the ending or give the answer, the solution to what's going on.
Which, as we just discussed, even when you watch it, you still won't really have the answer.
Exactly, exactly. And that's what I like. It gives answers, but still there are questions that linger.
Yes.
And I think for an animated 90, 100, 110 minute special, I think that's quite an accomplishment. I enjoyed it very much. It is thought-provoking, but you don't have to let it be thought-provoking.
Yeah, you can.
I mean, I think there is a level of lightness and goofiness, and there's a talking animal and a crazy little kid and a messed up little bit older kid, and they have adventures. There is that level to it as well.
Yes. Like I said, I honestly highly recommend it if any of our listeners are looking for something to watch with their maybe 9 to 12 year old kids. I highly recommend it for Halloween. Like I said, if you watch it during November, that's almost better. You know, pumpkins are everywhere, but so are turkeys. So are Christmas carols. You know, delightfully sinister use. It's fantastic. So, thank you for agreeing to watch this. But I'm really glad that you came with me and we went on this long, rambling journey into the unknown.
Thank you.
And we're back. We have great listeners who love to send us feedback. So now it's time to go through that big old bags of emails, faxes, and notes.
Chris Willett did some audio work for me back from my April Fool's Quarterben episode, which seems like it was 6 months ago.
Oops.
And I did use some of that audio at the time, totally forgetting that he included darkness to light feedback.
So here at last.
Slightly delayed.
Chris's thoughts on this show.
I really enjoyed your last episode of Darkness to Light and the Star Wars thing. And see, here's the deal. I loved Star Wars when I was a kid. I was born in 1974. That's where it was. I saw Empire in the theater, and I have vivid memories of being in our grade school gymnasium one day over summer break or something, and somebody had a copy of Star Wars on VHS, and they actually had a VHS player. It was all very amazing and technological and had faux wood grain on it. And I have vivid memories of like this empty gymnasium with this tiny television in the middle of it and Darth Vader on the screen, and there was like folding chairs and we were all sitting on them, and I was like mesmerized. And I don't know why. There's something weirdly minimalist and huge about this memory, and it's always been there. I actually became a Christian in my sophomore year of high school. And I don't know if you met those kids whose moms don't let them do anything unless it's Christian and then you can do it. And otherwise, no. I became that mom. At that point, I was cutting off like everything. And I just like dropped out of so much and was a bit obnoxious. But I dropped Star Wars. And then the prequels came out and I kept reading stuff about George Lucas and his whole, the pod race was going to make people stop thinking about Ben-Hur's chariot race. And I loved Ben-Hur at this point. And I still do. Ben-Hur is an awesome film. And so the prequels, with all their, like, Anakin being the Immaculate Conception, and then the whole, if you're not with me, you're against me. I forget how he paraphrased it, but only a Sith speaks like that. And of course, he was quoting Jesus. And like all of that, and it's just like, they were such crappy movies, and they had this bad attitude behind them, and I don't know how much that was me bringing to it, or Lucas. I think we met in the middle with our bad attitude, and so I was just totally done with Star Wars. But I really enjoyed the new one. It was a just solid, fun movie, and in it, I don't know, maybe this is just me reading in what I want, but J.J. Abrams' Fringe, which, by the way, if you wanted to do a whole Darkness to Light on the Fringe, that thing is amazing. And, you know, white flowers and saviors and only sons being sacrificed and just wall-to-wall nuts. But J.J. Abrams, obviously, is not afraid of weird and bizarre, and he's also not afraid of flat-out Christianity. It was kind of funny because I got this strange vibe where the Force was much more like a superpower and one you were developing as opposed to a religion. It's the difference that people, like, there are people who go and do yoga because yoga will help them and make them more healthy. And then there's other people who yoga is part of a very distinctive Eastern tradition and it's part of their religious practice. And I think this new Star Wars brought the Force more the way Eastern practices are presented in Batman than a actual religious thing. And then there was that weird stuff with C-3PO. I realize he said something about thank the Maker in one of the earlier films, but like he had thank the Maker and It's a Miracle almost back to back. And it was kind of funny because when I went to see JJ's Star Trek film, they're about to all go into space, and there was something like, go with God, or may God's peace be with you, or something like that. And I thought it was just really interesting that these series that have been known for being at odds with Christianity in ways and presenting ideas that may not be compatible, and J.J. Abrams gets them and seems to make them more universal and make the mystic stuff a little more human, but throwing in these nods to a Judeo-Christian faith. I don't know. hey, are you going to do a whole episode to jump on the Batman v Superman bandwagon, talking about the, like, 18 tons of Jesus symbolism in Man of Steel? Because I'm, of course, rewatching that, and I'm now noticing more than I did last time, and it was pretty nonstop. Anyway, okay, I'm rambling. Bye.
Thank you for, well, not really writing. Thank you for sending that in, Chris.
And like a fine wine, I think that feedback has just gotten better with age.
Yes. First of all, we have all been that mom. Yeah. Some of us try not to be. Some of us do a pretty good job of not being. We all go through that phase.
It's not a terrible instinct. It's just that we always go overboard. The pendulum swings at least a little too far. Almost always way too far. And it's not that we always bring back all of those things back into our lives, but we do selectively bring some of those things back.
Yeah, I think we can call the coalition of Christian mothers against Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I think we can say that that was probably a little bit too far.
Yeah.
Then again, Christian mainstream pop culture is always about 10 to 15 years behind everyone, so we were due for our moral panic.
I thought he had an interesting take on Star Wars.
Yes.
In terms of where sort of the Christian imagery comes in and comes out, and talking about his reactions to that. It was sort of a particular take that I hadn't heard before.
Yes. Adding to the conversation. We talked about this last time, but you guys did indeed miss out on the Batman v Superman episode.
That's good.
Man, that, you know, Batman v Superman may have been slightly less Jesus than Man of Steel. In the words of my roommate, there's nothing wrong with that movie that 100% more Diana and 70% less Jesus would not have fixed. And I have to agree.
Yeah. We got a nice thank you from the guys at the Fear of God podcast for saying nice things about them in our last episode.
Also in last episode, we featured music from the band Insomniac Folklore, as well as having an intro from frontman Tyler Henschel. We tagged him in the episode. He thanked us for including the music, supporting the band, etc., etc. So that was cool.
And speaking of music, our buddy Stella from the Batgirl to Oracle podcast said that she appreciated our use of Switchfoot in the Kingdom Come episode.
It's a great song.
The falling skies.
Falling skies and rising tides. And it's more than a CCM song. But it still has some of those water images.
I thought it was a good mix.
Jason Marcinette also wrote in about the Kingdom Come episode. Good stuff. Tell Emily that I agree on Diana and Clark. Yes! Validate my ships! That was the first of our Dorkness episodes that he listened to.
Thank you, Michael Bailey.
And has since worked his way through our past episodes and sent back. I haven't listened to all your episodes yet, but I enjoy what I have heard so far. I went to Christian private school from kindergarten through 12th grade and grew up going to a Presbyterian church, so it's all in my wheelhouse.
Now, when I hear that someone went to Christian private school their whole lives, my only conclusion is they had awesome, loving parents. Emily, your comments.
I think that
we tried, speaking for Mr. and Mrs. Marcinette, we tried. We did our best.
I'm just saying, judging from that information, there is a 100% chance that for some portion of Jason's life, he was that mom.
We also heard back from our old buddy, Hawk Carr, who may now hold the record for the most feedbacked upon iTunes review ever.
We might just have to put the iTunes review discourse, like, just in our promo. Just like, by the way, you're signing up for this.
He wanted to clarify again what he'd said about our show. Hey, in my iTunes review, I wrote somewhat scholarly and still enjoyable in my review. I also wrote this gem of a podcast, which you conveniently forget. I did not write surprisingly less boring than you'd think. I know, it's what's the difference in the definition between imply and infer? This whole conversation is going on the SATs as an example of that.
We are an example in pedantry.
Seriously, though, he says, I really do enjoy your sarcastic irreverence, and thanks for the mention.
And the mention, and the mention, and the mention, and the mention.
And Hawk, thanks for being a good sport.
Gene Hendricks commented about the grab bag episode, commending us on pulling together so many disparate topics. They really couldn't have been full episodes on their own. Well, maybe Emily's fantasy of beating understanding into a young Calvinist would, and I'm sure it would be very entertaining. It would just turn into 10 dual commandments from Hamilton. Like, it would just be a hardcore smackdown. It would not be good.
So, are you saying Lin-Manuel Miranda should move to 4th century church history, or do the Reformation, post-Reformation,
I mean,
next? I mean, you can't go wrong in either case. You've got characters, you've got drama, you've got Moida. You've got it all.
I mean, both of them do have plenty of fleeing the country, which I think any musical that involves fleeing the country as a primary plot point, gold. Gene's email continues, I can't really comment on much of what you covered since it's all so far out of my wheelhouse, and I'd just make a fool of myself if I said anything. I am glad there's so much stuff out there that you like in this vein. Gene.
Thank you, Gene. Bradley Null chimed in, a pretty similar vein to Gene, although even more concise. Great episode, fun listen, not much to comment on, not much time to do it in as well.
Now, okay.
If I remember past history, Bradley listens in his car, and occasionally feedbacks from his car.
So again,
depending on the length of the red light,
we here at Dorkness to Light podcasts do not endorse texting while driving, feedbacking while, don't do it. Drive safely, kids.
Thanks, Bradley. Separately, he wrote in to make a topic recommendation of Alan Moore's Promethea, which has been recommended before, possibly before by Bradley. I can't remember. Someone else has recommended that before, as he said, it's a Kabbalistic take on Shazam.
I'm really interested in reading Promethea. I'm not sure if we're actually going to talk about it on a podcast, just because, as you can tell from this episode, I'm kind of pushing us for some more weird and esoteric stuff, though the Kabbalah
it's
does fall
Alan Moore.
Into this.
It's Alan Moore. It's going to be out there. So it might fit that side of our wheelhouse. You never know.
It's possible. So I'm definitely going to read it, though.
We try not to make promises about content.
Yeah, it's a dangerous road. Dangerous road to walk alone.
I have been planning to make it part of my vague future potential podcast. Ooh. I'm rereading the series and found notes from the last time I read it.
Well, if you are taking notes on your comic book, Brad, that is definitely step one to the inevitable madness that is podcasting.
Whenever that day comes, brother, we will welcome you to the fold. The problem is, Bradley already has a number of perfect names for the show. I'm going for Null and Void. Mm. He's come up with similar puns. As we learned, the first step to podcasting is coming up with a name for the show. Did want to also thank Bradley and Clinton Robinson and Ed Moore for resharing that last episode of the podcast on Facebook. Appreciate all the support, everybody.
So thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode. If you have any comments about Halloween and liminal spaces, if you want to tell us what your go-to Halloween viewing is and why, feel free to send us any of that information. We'd be very interested in hearing about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to wish everyone a happy Halloween, a fantastic PSL season.
And may the Force be with you.
And also with you.
While you're waiting for the next podcast episode, check out our websites. DorknessToLight.blogspot.com contains reviews, essays, and other similar ramblings.
And dorknesstolight.tumblr.com, which contains some of that material, as well as top tens, cool photographs, memes, and religious puns. We also run a general interest comic book podcast network, Relatively Geeky. That content can be found at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or by searching iTunes for Relatively Geeky.
Let us know what you think of this topic,
this episode, or this podcast in general. Feel free to send your thoughts to us at dorknesstolight@gmail.com. We would also appreciate any ratings or reviews left for the podcast in the iTunes store to help like-minded people find us.
Clips and additional music in this episode were from Over the Garden Wall and Van Morrison.
Our intro, outro, and promo music is by Anderson Kale. Check them out at andersonkale.com or search iTunes to purchase their music.
Thanks for listening.